As the season of consumption opens, we're wondering about scarcity. Is it real, a fact of nature, the bedrock of all our plans? Or is it, as our guest on Culture File this time suggests, something set in motion by a series of processes we can shape, as carefully constructed as a seasonal drought of frozen dolls? Jeremy Till is an architect and academic who's head of Central St. Martin's University of the Arts in London and co-author of a new book on the subject. Scarcity is a manifesto of sorts which calls on designers and architects to look beyond questions of doing more with less, to see new ways of living on Earth. But in a world where being radical is now synonymous with terrorism, is rethinking more unlikely than ever? But let's start at the beginning.
Scarcity we define right at the beginning in a very simple manner, which is lack, which is the basic medieval, comes from escarte, which is a lack. And what we then do is to understand that that lack is not a simple thing of not having enough. That lack is always constructed. But it's fine to say it's a lack, because everyone understands that. But beyond that, it's not fine to accept it as a pure lack, that it's always in some way impure, because it's always constructed. But our real argument is that scarcity is much more complex than just simple lack. It's a social and political construction.
You talk about the Janus-like complexion of designers, in that they are dealing with scarcity at one point, but also producing desire at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, there's two things that designers do. One is they address need, which I think is a necessary thing to do. But the other thing is that they create scarcity by creating desire, by creating objects which have desire built into them through the act of design. They actually fuel the whole consumption and patterns of the marketplace, which in turn fuel scarcity. In standard economic theory, scarcity is taken as a given. And in that, economic theory, particularly neoclassical economic theory, states that what we're trying to do is deal with that given, deal with the scarcity of means. How do we overcome that scarcity of means? And with that, what the assumption is that scarcity is unavoidable. Whereas in fact, what we're arguing is that scarcity, as always constructed, can be avoided, and in that we can begin to look at different ways of dealing with it. Things are running out, but they're running out because of our patterns of behavior. How do we change our patterns of behavior in order to mitigate scarcity?
You use an example of land in Ethiopia as a kind of an emblem of how scarcity happens.
Well, it's not only how scarcity happens, but it's also how the specter of scarcity is used. And in that, it creates, in its wake, another set of scarcities. So with biofuel, the argument is we're running out of fossil fuels. Therefore, we have to find alternative forms of energy. And one of those alternative forms, apparently, is biofuels. That, therefore, legitimates Western and European and to some extent the Chinese to make land grabs in Ethiopia and in other bits of sub-Saharan Africa, and in that create scarcities in its weight, because those land grabs, making biofuel in sub-Saharan Africa, gets rid of the indigenous farmers, it leads to food shortages there, etc., etc. So that the specter of scarcity, which is used the whole time, it's being used absolutely at the moment in this age of austerity. The spectre of scarcity of not enough money is being used as an excuse to enforce the regimes of austerity.
At this point in the conversation, somebody would say, and designers have a lot to bring to this question of re-engineering this, and design thinking might be the answer here. And in fact, in the book, I was surprised to see you kind of suggest design thinking might just be another SOP to support something unsustainable.
Design thinking is being used and appropriated by business schools and by market economy in order just to make them work a bit better. However, I think there are other ways of using design as a way of joining things up, so as a way of understanding exactly the construction of scarcities. And what designers are very good at is understanding, looking from the side, and therefore understanding those constructions, and then seeing how to intervene in them. So I think that there is a role for design thinking, as long as it's not simply as another method to keep on trying to escape from scarcity in the hope of endless growth.
But it's hard to envisage design thinking at the moment being anything more than that. It must support this system.
It is, and I think that's where the book, in a way, might end in, I wouldn't say a weakness, but without setting out an absolutely clear stall. And the reason it can't set out a clear stall is that I think collectively we have to start reimagining new futures within a post-growth society. But to say post-growth is an act of treason to most people. And I think I think that collectively we have to acknowledge that we are going to be living in a post-growth society, that endless growth is not sustainable in every sense of the word. And therefore, design thinking, I think, is useful at that moment, because what designers do also is to reimagine. I can't come up with a prescription, though. That has to be done as a collective. I can't suddenly say, OK, if we move towards specific modes of designing new societal futures in a very specific manner, because it would depend on context, it would depend on particular politics, et cetera, et cetera.
One of the ways you approach it is looking at the terms and a term like growth and seeing what is intrinsic in that and what might be even redesigned about the term.
Well, exactly. I mean, what does growth mean? Growth at the moment is defined simply in terms of economics, in terms of the growth of GDP. How do you measure other forms of growth, which those very reductive measures ignore? How do you measure growth of well-being? How do you measure growth of equality? How do you measure growth of happiness? Now, those, even saying that, it might sound really stupid. Growth of happiness going out on the radio may sound a really stupid thing to say, but actually, possibly it's a very necessary thing to say, because it posits an alternative to the standard systems of measuring of growth. And in issues about well-being, in issues of equality, in issues of happiness, of course, what we're doing is we're talking about human consequences, whereas what by talking about growth simply in terms of numbers, there's a kind of tendency, not only tendency, but what happens is that it abstracts exactly those human relationships. It turns them into something which is actions of pure measure. And exactly that's what happened in 2008, that the bankers were simply piling economic machines and tools one on top of the other in a kind of moments of madness without ever understanding their human consequences. And yet the human consequences, we're kind of milliseconds behind the madness of this kind of endless growth.
Jeremy Till there at Central St Martin's University of the Arts in London, and we'll have the second part of that conversation next time on Culture File, but I'll warn you now, nobody has all the answers.